in the United States, as in many countries, sexual assault is a big problem. Only 25 out of every 1,000 rapists in the United States are ever jailed for their crimes. Indeed, most sexual assaults go unreported for a variety of reasons. It's his word against hers. The victim feels embarrassed, ashamed, or humiliated, or the trauma is so severe that the victim just can't bring herself to report the crime, lest she be called to testify in court and relive the whole nightmare. As bad as these numbers might seem, though, they're better than they used to be. Why? Because some victims are brave enough to fight back, even when that fight takes decades. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Early in the morning of October 15th, 1983, Lisa Saruga was asleep in her dorm room at Central Michigan University when she was awakened by a man in the room. The man had a knife. He told her that he wouldn't hurt her as long as she did what he told her to do. He forced himself on her twice, and when she wouldn't cooperate with him, he cut her legs with the knife. During the attack, she banged on the wall and screamed for help. She even tried to gouge his eyes out to try to stop him. After the attack, the man told Lisa to go to sleep. He even stood outside her door waiting for her to fall asleep. And every few minutes, he would peek into the room to see if she was still awake. She felt like a hostage. When he finally left, Lisa locked the door and called her boyfriend. He and a friend rushed her to a hospital. In the 35 years since that attack, Lisa has dedicated her life to helping the victims of violent crime, to strengthening legislation to protect victims and to punish perpetrators, and to help victims regain their mental health. After graduating from Central Michigan University, Lisa Saruga attended Bowling Green University, where she earned two master's degrees, one in counseling and another in higher education administration. Lisa is an author, speaker, and licensed counselor, and she joins us today. Lisa, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, Lisa, where do we even begin with this story? First, I want to say how brave you are and how brave you have been. It's an unusual person who takes a trauma and uses that awful experience to help others. Tell us about that. You were attacked in 1983, but you finished school and you went on to two master's degrees. When was it that you decided to go into activism? Was it a progression, or did you jump in with both feet?
I did jump in with both feet, but it wasn't right away. When that crime occurred, I was actually studying music. I had always planned to study music. And after I experienced that crime, I changed my major to political science because I was going to be an attorney so that I could put bad guys behind bars. And I actually, as I was starting law school, got a job with a big law firm in Toledo, Ohio. And what I noticed was, you know, nobody was going to jail for their crimes, especially when it comes to sexual assault. Only 2.5% of rapists go to jail, and yet 100% of the victim survivors serve a life sentence. And so it was at that time that I decided I was going to go into counseling and work with victims. That's what I did right away, but I didn't talk about my own story until my cold case opened 35 years later. I didn't talk about it. I wasn't active. I just kind of put it away in the back of my mind. I didn't want to think about it. But when my cold case reopened, that's when I jumped in with both feet. That's when I really realized that there's just so many reasons that perpetrators don't go to jail. And I started researching and researching. And what happened was on the 35th anniversary of the crime, I decided I wasn't going to sit home and mope. I wanted to start making a difference. So I started calling legislators, attorneys. It's interesting because some people were calling me too. I started hearing from some of the key players in the Larry Nassar case. And every one of them encouraged me to continue with what I was doing. Every one of them said, you need to write a book, something I had never planned to do. And so on that day, it's interesting because as I was making the calls, one of the legislators I called their office said, he's actually in your hometown. He's going to do a debate tonight. This was representative, he was my representative, Representative Bill Huizinga. So I went to the debate, and the very first question in that debate was about sexual violence, which is really unusual for a political debate. So I started writing a little letter to him, and as I was walking out, I thought, if I can catch him, I'll give him my letter. He actually stopped me. He thought that he knew me and said, you know, so good to see you. And so I was able to give him this letter. And the next morning he called me, said he was willing to work with me and invited me to Washington, D.C. And so that's when I started just knocking on doors in legislators' offices.
Fantastic. I think we can divide your work, frankly, into three categories, maybe even more than three. You're a counselor and therapist. You're a lobbyist for important legislation. You're an author and speaker. Walk us through this. How did it all come together?
It's kind of a hodgepodge of things. You know, it's funny because my family always teased me because I've been educated in music, political science, counseling, college student personnel, and they would say, you know, are you just going to get a whole bunch of degrees? You can't. What are you going to do with all those degrees? And I'm using every one of them now. I think by the time my cold case was reopened, I was pretty uniquely equipped to address some things. I was a legal and ethical specialist. I was very comfortable working with legislators. I had been a trauma therapist for almost 30 years, so I have that expertise. So it worked out that writing is something I like. I love to speak. I'm a good talker, John. So speaking seemed pretty natural. And so as these key players in the Nassar case, some people from the Michigan Attorney General's office and legislators started encouraging. I just became more and more passionate about the whole topic of sexual violence. So I started speaking first to a lot to faith-based groups, and then that kind of took off. And I started keynote speaking on college campuses for Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and started writing my story, and it just kind of all rolled on from there.
Lisa, I have one more question about your case. Back in 2018, you got a call from the police who told you that they had reopened your case and that they actually had a suspect. It turned out that a man at Central Michigan reported years after the fact that a former friend of his had confessed to the crime against you. Is that how you were able to confront your attacker?
Not at first, John. When that person stepped forward and reported, the perpetrator wore a ski mask, so I never saw his face. I couldn't identify him. But when this person came forward and reported the confession, my cold case was reopened for about 3 months. And what happened during that time is kind of crazy. So in Michigan, there is no statute of limitations on a law or on a crime that is that violent now. But there was a statute of limitations in 1983, and that's when the crime happened. So they had to use that old law, and because of that, he couldn't be arrested. He's a free man. He's a wealthy businessman with a clean record, even though he's been caught two other times in sex-related crimes that have been expunged from his record. So what happened was, they closed the case. And I received a call from the Michigan Attorney General's office. A special agent called to tell me that they felt there were significant safety issues for me. This guy is a person of interest in two rape homicides now. And he didn't know my name, the perpetrator, but he knew that he had been identified in my case and that I could be a witness in those other cases if he could be connected to those crimes. So what they were saying is, you know, he could be looking for you. So they also told me that the laws as they stand now protect him as an innocent person, but they didn't protect me. So even if I were to go public with his name, to expose him, to confront him, he could sue me. And so it was really a strange time at first because I couldn't confront him. I didn't want him to know who I was. I didn't want him to know where I lived. So we had to just not make any contact with him at that time.
My God, I didn't know that. Lisa, you've been working with two great Emmy-winning journalists on a hard-hitting documentary about your experience. It's not out yet, but as part of the documentary, you were able to confront your attacker. What was that like? Did you feel any closure or did it make you angry?
First off, John, I want to thank you because you introduced me to those Emmy Award-winning this team. So Brian Ross and Rhonda Schwartz from the Law and Crime Network took interest in my story, and we've been filming for about 3 years, this documentary that'll come out later this year. And as part of that, just over a year ago, the Law and Crime Network graciously took the position that they would go ahead and expose him. They would take that legal risk, which is great. I didn't have to give them his name. I am not exposing this man. I'm not putting myself out there, making myself vulnerable to being sued. So what they did, they surveilled him for about 3 months to figure out what his patterns were, where he was, and they figured out that he went to the gym 3 hours a day. And so Brian Ross and a team met me in this man's hometown, and we went. It was kind of crazy. We went and sat in a dark suburban and kind of waited for him to come out of the gym. There were people inside that were monitoring him, and there were people outside, and we had security there, and it was really crazy. But when he walked out of the gym, I just got out of the car and walked up and confronted him. It was almost surreal to, I had never seen his face. It was scary, and I wasn't sure how I would react. Brian Ross kept asking me, "What are you going to say to him?" And I don't have any idea. What do you say to a person you've never met or seen who's done something like this to you? But in the moment, I was surprised because I walked up to him and I felt so confident confronting him. I just walked up and said, "Hey, do you remember me?" And he said, "I'm trying to think." And it was, and then he saw the cameras and he saw the sound crew, and he knew who I was. And his face, there was this terror on his face. And in that moment, it was like I felt this transfer of powers where I felt very confident and he looked very terrified, which is just the opposite of what it had been for 35 years. So I think that's the greatest thing that came out of it was getting my confidence back. I felt like I had taken that power back for myself.
Incredible. Lisa, stay right there. We're speaking with author, speaker, and counselor Lisa Saruga about sexual assault and other violent crimes. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to go into a little more detail about Lisa's case, and we'll talk about the future of prosecuting these very difficult cases. Stay tuned.
Under the Russian state control narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
To come here since I was 12, when my grandfather told me that his mom came from Russia, that I was part Russian. I didn't plan on staying this long. I was going to look around. I was going to see if it was for me. But then I came, and then I was like, I don't ever want to go home.
I've never been happier in life than I am here in Russia.
I've only lived here a few months, but I wanted to tell you what fascinates me about Russia and share the stories of other foreigners who live here. Like Jay, who worked as a chef and now raises goats and makes cheese in the countryside.
Cheese.
Like Chad, who's been granted political asylum because he's being persecuted by the FBI.
U.S. embassies in four countries that come after me. It's wild.
Like an American family that recently moved to Russia with six children.
I've never felt safer in my entire life than living here.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Lisa Saruga, who's a licensed professional counselor specializing in trauma therapy. She's an author, speaker, and legislative advocate. Good to have you with us, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
Lisa, I'd like to get into some broader issues now. You and I get together every time you come to Washington, and you're involved in some very important work. You meet regularly with members of Congress and with senior staff members. I can tell you from my own experience on Capitol Hill that it is very unusual for somebody to meet personally with the member. But you do. You have that access. Tell us what kind of legislation you're working on. What's the end result going to be?
Well, at the federal level, we'll start there in Washington, D.C. First of all, crimes related to sexual violence, sexual assault, are all handled at the state level in the United States, not at the federal level. So some people were questioning, why would you go to Washington, D.C.? Well, there are some things at the federal level that have really tied the hands of the states to be able to make arrests in these cases. So one of the things that we're looking at is there's a case called Stogner versus California that the Supreme Court decided. When the Supreme Court made that decision, it became precedence. And so all of the states have to abide by this decision. And the decision was based on the ex post facto clause in our Constitution that the Supreme Court determined that you can't remove a statute of limitations from a crime retroactively. And the reason for that is the ex post facto clause, when it was put into the Constitution, said that it's manifestly unjust and oppressive to arrest somebody for something that wasn't illegal when they did it. That makes sense. It also says that you can't change the level of crime it is. So let's say it was a misdemeanor when it was done, and now it's a felony. That would be unjust. You can't increase the punishment or change the legal rules of evidence. But in my case, rape was illegal. It was a felony. The punishment was the same now as it is. It was the same then as it is now, which is life in prison or up to 25 years in prison. And so what I was trying to illustrate is that the majority of victim survivors have no pathway to justice. And I think that's manifestly unjust and oppressive. And so that's kind of the approach that we're taking. And I've done a lot of research into it in ways that it could be overturned by Congress through an act or through a constitutional amendment. There's several ways that it could happen. I did try to get my own state to challenge Stogner by creating a law that it would be unconstitutional and hope that it would be appealed due to the Supreme Court. But that takes a long time and a whole lot of money. And we had a legislator in Michigan that didn't want to see that happen. And so it didn't go through. The lack of justice, too, John, is not just in America. There's a lack of justice in this area globally. And in the United States, we often hear our media people talking about, the lack of human rights in other countries. And they often refer to sexual assault as an attack on human rights in other countries. But what I think a lot of Americans don't realize is that there's almost 200 nations, recognized nations, in our world. And when you look at the level of sexual assault, the number of sexual assaults that occur in a year, the United States is fourth on that list. So there's Botswana, South Africa, and Lesotho. Those are the top three, and then the United States of America. So we have a human rights issue right here on our own soil, and we have laws that are preventing us from ending that. So Stogner is one of the things. And then also we've been looking into making sexual assaults a federal crime. It's a state crime right now. And it's pretty complicated to explain it, but there is an article by Donald A. Drips. He did research and presented in the William and Mary Law Review why rape could be a national crime to the limits of commerce. And so there's a lot of innuendo and a lot of details that go along with that I've researched and have also presented. One of the stories that I tell when I talk to legislators is, consider this. A man who served time for a prior felony steals a car by threatening the owner with an unloaded gun. He stops at a gas station, steals cash from the clerk while flashing the same unloaded gun. He forces a woman into that car and drives to the next county where he rapes her. Now, a convicted felon in possession of a gun, that's a federal offense because of the Gun Control Act. The federal carjacking statute makes stealing the car a federal offense. Under the Hobbs Act, robbery is a felony, a federal offense. The Lindbergh Act makes kidnapping a federal offense. Using the FBI hierarchy of violent crimes, the most violent crime this person committed was the rape. And it's the only crime committed that's not a federal offense. So that's another area that we're looking at the national level.
Wow. Wow. Tell us what's happening then at the state level. You've had success at the federal level, but are the states doing enough to prevent sexual assaults or to punish the perpetrators when those crimes take place?
You know, to be fair, I think the state's hands are tied by some federal decisions. Again, you know, trying to pass legislation to make the removal of statute of limitations retroactive. You know, I go to the state level and there's always somebody in that chain of command who says, that's unconstitutional, so we can't make that law. And the fact is we need to make an unconstitutional law in order to challenge it. So so I did have an active bill. I wrote a bill for the Michigan House of Representatives, and it was active for 3 years, but again, the chair of the committee that it went to refused to schedule a hearing because it was unconstitutional. So there's little blocks every step of the way. I really think that our best bet now moving forward is I'm going to propose that we pass a law similar to the New York Adult Survivors Act. And if you're not familiar with that, last year was the year that took place. And the New York decided to give anybody who had experienced sexual violence who couldn't get justice because of statutes of limitations specifically, they could, for 1 year, they opened a one-year time frame that people could sue in civil court the perpetrator. It does not allow for arrests or any criminal action, but it does give victims some kind of bone. they can at least sue civilly and kind of have their day in court. So that's what we're looking at now. Basically, I see this as the state and federal governments have laws that are just so tangled up like spaghetti, and I feel like we just need to unravel that knot. And again, my case really does demonstrate the knot. If you think about it, my cold case was solved 35 years later. The statute of limitations when the crime occurred was only 8 years, I think. And so 35 years later, you know, basically my perpetrator won the game. He hid his identity long enough that he couldn't be arrested, right? So although there's no statute of limitations, Now, in Michigan, there was an 83. And when the statute of limitations was removed, it couldn't be retroactive because of the federal decision of the Supreme Court, Stadner versus California. And then even though the crime punishment, level of felony, everything didn't change, he still couldn't be arrested. So as a result, my perpetrator, he couldn't be arrested or indicted at the state level, but because he knew that he had been identified in my case, of course, I said there were safety issues. And so when I was notified of that, I was also notified that I could have no help with those safety issues because the federal government is who offers victim protection. But the federal government only offers protection if there's a conviction, and the state can't convict if they can't indict. So it's catch 22. It's just this never ending cycle. There's too many ways for perpetrators to beat the system.
How can people learn more about the work that you're doing and about the documentary, and where can they read what you're writing?
Thank you for asking that question. My website is lisasaruga.com, and I will be keeping people updated and notified about legislation, writing, all of that. My first book is coming out February 11th. It's called The Trauma Tree, Going Beyond Trauma, Growing Toward Wholeness. It comes out February 11th, 2025. And it's really just written from my perspective of expertise as a trauma therapist, but also my experience as a trauma survivor. It has bits and pieces of my story in it, but that book is going to come out at a later date. So that's the next thing to come out. The documentary should be airing by the end of this year, 2024. We don't know what platform yet. The Law and Crime Network is producing and editing and putting together the documentary, but it is possible that it'll sell to another network. So we don't know exactly the platform. But if you keep posted at my website and social media, all of that will be available. And then speaking, I do speak nationwide. If somebody's interested in having me speak, you can schedule that right through my website also.
Lisa Saruga, thank you so much for being with us. Former President Ronald Reagan once said, quote, "For too long, the victims of crime have been the forgotten persons of our criminal justice system. Rarely do we give victims the help they need or the attention they deserve. Yet the protection of our citizens to guard them from becoming victims is the primary purpose of our penal laws," unquote. That should be a given, but it's not. Real change is made by individuals. Real change is made by people like Lisa Saruga. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Please follow me on Substack at John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.